The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'll call to order the Higher Education Finance Policy Committee. Representative Dorholt, do you have a motion for us?
I move to pass the minutes of...
Representative Dorholt moves to approve the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, we are going to overview the University of Minnesota's bonding request. This is somewhat similar to what we did with Minsky. There are overriding issues of the size of the bonding bill, the use of cash. We have concerns about higher education asset preservation, what's in that in both Minsky and the university. And then I'm sure that the university will show us the discrepancies between the governor's capital investment bill and what they would like to see in the House and the Senate capital investment bill. And then, as always, what consequences there would be to having or not having items in the bill. So with that, President Kaler, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Kaler, President of the University of Minnesota, and I'm joined at the stand today by Pam Wheelock, Vice President for University Services, and we together will walk you through a brief slideshow summary of our request. And Mr. Chair, a year ago I sat before you and this committee and I told you what our priorities were. They were to put a lid on tuition for Minnesota students and to fund a research initiative that highlighted the scholarly strengths of the U and lined with needs and opportunities in the state. And I'm very grateful that in the end this committee partnered with the students and faculty of the state's only land-grant university. You helped us freeze tuition for Minnesota resident undergraduates, and you helped fund a key research initiative, MinDrive, which is a wonderful acronym standing for Minnesota Discovery Research and Innovation Economy. Feedback from students, parents, and the scientific community has been overwhelmingly positive, and I just want to say thank you for that endorsement and that investment before I start with my presentation today. Thank you. Today, we are before you to speak about facilities. And I will add an additional thank you for the facilities you've already provided. The university's new physics and nanotechnology building, shown on the right-hand side part of the slide, which will celebrate its grand opening on April 24th. And thank you also for supporting funding for the gateway to our spectacular biomedical discovery district, the new cancer and cardiovascular research building, which opened last year. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this could not have happened without your wise investment. You demonstrated great faith in us and in higher education, and I pledge to you that we will continue to be good stewards of those resources you have shared with us. Mr. Chair, let me quickly review for you some basics. You have in your packet copies of the small collection of slides we're displaying, and they outline our three-pronged mission as Minnesota's only public land-grant research university. Research and discovery, creating new ideas, products, cures, and treatments. Teaching and learning, preparing the state's workforce for tomorrow and the days and years after tomorrow. And outreach and public engagement, working with communities across the state to tackle and solve some of Minnesota's most pressing challenges. As for our students, we're serving 15% more students than we did at the turn of this century, and 73% of them are Minnesota residents. In 2012, more than 46,000 students received financial aid. The U itself awarded more than $76 million in aid. We award 100% of Minnesota's dentistry, pharmacy, and veterinary medicine degrees, and our four-year undergraduate graduation rates have doubled over the past 14 years, moving students more quickly to the state's workforce. And I'll remind you that about 70% of all healthcare professionals in the state were trained at the university. On the research front, despite massive federal cutbacks, we attracted $749 million in research funding last year, ninth among public research universities in a state that's the 21st largest. We continue to launch startups based on technology and intellectual property developed by our faculty. So I think the bottom line is clear and dramatic. We are the economic and innovation engine for the state, with every state dollar invested in the university returning $13.20 to the statewide economy. Let me now turn to this year's capital request, based on principles our Board of Regents uses when developing our six-year capital plan. Our request seeks to ensure student success, first and foremost, to ensure research impact, to fulfill our statewide mission, to protect our public assets and investment, and to responsibly manage the university's resources. This year, make no doubt, we are asking for substantial facilities support. And we are mobilizing the university community, including our alumni, so that all legislators come to understand the value we bring to the state and understand the importance of our request. In this day and age, we simply need modern facilities to replicate the real industry and workplace our environments our graduates move into. Vice President Wheelock will talk about each of the components of the request, and all are as important as approved by the Board of Regents. But let me be very clear. HEPR funding is our top priority. On our Twin Cities campus alone, about 30% of all of our buildings were constructed 70 years ago or earlier. And across our campus, it's about 25% built as long ago as the 1940s. As President Obama said yesterday when he was in, last week when he was in St. Paul, these facilities are old enough to qualify for Medicare. We absolutely must get in these buildings, replace roofs, repair windows, repair electrical, plumbing, and other infrastructure. We need to preserve our assets. We need state investment for 71 projects, from Crookston to Morris, from Duluth to Rochester, and here in the Twin Cities. 3 years ago, my wife, Karen, coined the phrase, HEPR is cheaper. And it's true. It is far more cost-effective for us to get into these facilities now than wait for a complete rebuild to be necessary. We're also seeking renovations and new construction for many science, technology, engineering, and math facilities, including labs that will help the state fight invasive aquatic species and strengthen the chemical sciences and advanced material sciences on our Duluth campus, positively impacting the economy of Northeast Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, we are seeking a partnership with you and your colleagues to help fund facilities to ensure we can fulfill our mission of solving Minnesota's biggest problems and of preparing the next generation of leaders for the state and our economy. We cannot educate and train the workforce of tomorrow in last century's facilities. Thank you for listening. Thank you for consideration of our request. And, Mr. Chair, with your approval, I will turn over the presentation to Vice President Wheelock.
Vice President Wheelock, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pamela Wheelock, Vice President of University Services for the University of Minnesota. Let me carry on the conversation around HEPR, and this is a very important part of our request. All of our projects before you are listed in priority order and have been approved by the Board of Regents in that priority order. And obviously, HEPR is our biggest priority with a $100 million request. Right now, the governor has recommended funding for that at $40 million. So HEPR-eligible projects, as you know, improve safety and
Vice President Wheelock, I asked this question of Minsky, so I'm going to interrupt you for a second. Can you explain why the governor's request is so low? What was the rationale for his request being less than half?
Mr. Chair, I'm unaware that there was any explanation that was provided to us by the governor's office on that item, and so I can't elaborate.
All right. Proceed.
So the HEPR-eligible projects improve safety and accessibility and, importantly, extend the useful life of the public investment that was already made in the buildings, improve energy efficiency and other critical systems in the building. They reduce these investments reduce operating costs, leverage external research funding, and enhance student experience. On this particular slide, it illustrates that the HEPR funding actually is funds projects across the university system. We've highlighted a few of them here for the Andrew Boss Meat Law Lab on the St. Paul campus that will fund fire sprinkler systems and abatement of materials in the existing lab, for Blakely Hall elevator access on the Morris campus. This is one of our historic buildings on the quad, the last vestige of when it was a residence school. Today it is the Center for Student Life. Unfortunately, it has inadequate ADA access, so it limits the use of the facility because they have stairs approaching the entry, and that needs to be updated to become ADA accessible for our students. Chino Hall in Duluth is the replacement of mechanical system to heat and cool the building and ensure appropriate air quality. And then on the University of Minnesota, the Twin Cities campus, the picture on the left is for mechanical engineering. This is a very important building for a very renowned mechanical engineering department at the University of Minnesota. We have about 900 students in that program. It awards about 200 bachelor's of science degrees each year, up 33% from 2007. But when a forensic building study was completed by RSP Architects in late 2008, the building's electrical and mechanical systems were deemed to be far beyond their expected life. And major deficiencies and limitations based on today's codes about the use of the building in areas of electrical systems, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, ADA accessibility, stair enclosures, bathrooms, elevators, windows. So the various reports and surveys contained in that document clearly suggest that a complete renovation of mechanical engineering building is warranted. So that is a prime example of how the eligible uses of HEPR are contained even within one building within the heart of the campus for a very important program.
Vice President Relick, I'm going to stop you for a second here, too. I notice you have Morris and Duluth. I don't need to bring up, there's been some discussion about how the main campus treats other campuses in the states. So can you explain the input that these campuses would have had on the bonding, and are they also fully supportive of the request as it stands in reference to their particular campus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, the prioritization of PEPR projects are actually determined by each system campus. So they provide us with their list of priorities based on the allocation of PEPR funds driven by enrollment and physical plant. And so those requests are actually determined by and provided to the central staff by each system campus. So this is UMD's, Morris's, Crookston's set of priorities.
All right. So, Vice President, you would say then that the highest priority of each of these campuses is included in the HEPR request?
That is correct.
All right. Proceed.
So if we could move on to Tate Laboratory. As referenced, the original building constructed in 1926 received its last major renovation in 1956. So it is a very well-built building, but the outdated infrastructure and the spatial configuration of the research and teaching environments aren't well-suited to technology-driven disciplines in earth sciences and physics. The current the college enrollment and science teaching impacts high numbers of undergraduates. There are actually almost 5,000, about 4,800 students annually learn in this building. So the renovation will retain and stabilize the existing building while inserting new space within the interior footprint of the building. So the space will be rebuilt with an equivalent amount of classroom space, teaching and research labs, and support spaces for departmental operations. Microbial sciences. Earlier in our remarks, you heard the president note the commitments made by the state of Minnesota through MnDrive in the 2013 session. You may know that MnDrive is organized around four key leading initiatives. Two of these, food safety as well as the bioremediation of environmental conditions, are the focus of many of the St. Paul's plant and animal microbial research community. The translational potential for applied research in those fields to break up bottlenecks in Minnesota industry where persistent problems have not been overcome and development has been stalled is being observed in work already underway. An example of that might be the development that uses microbes to moderate toxicity of metals, removing metals from waste streams and supporting cleaner mining processes, or the research that shows that chemical contaminants in water used to fracture shale for natural gas extraction can be remediated by carefully matched microbial agents. So the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences, the College of Biological Sciences, and the College of Vet Med, who actually do similar work in plant and animal microbial sciences, are collaborating to house their researchers to collaborate on research as well. And the space is actually being designed to facilitate that work instead of to house various unique departments. The project would create new space adjacent to the Cargill building on the St. Paul campus, and that Cargill building is home to the Microbial and Plant Genomics Institute and was an early model for that shared space and collaboration. Crookston, the Campus Wellness Center, the number of students who reside on campus has grown significantly since 2006. There are actually three new residence halls on that campus housing an additional 300 students. But these students have limited recreational choices at that campus. As a result of the age of the facilities, the main sports building was constructed in the early 1900s and expanded in 1980. But the crowding in the existing buildings limits the use of the facilities. So it is used for the student athletes at the Crookston campus, and the other student body population has limited access to those facilities until sometimes 10 at night. And as well, the infrastructure of the existing buildings are limited in terms of HVAC and the suitability for the use in that space. So with the additional space proposed for the Wellness Center, Crookston will be have facilities comparable to many of its peers, and recruitment and retention of students in Crookston is greatly enhanced by updating these facilities. This is the top priority for the Chancellor at Crookston. For the Lab Improvement Fund, our request is for $18 million, $12 million of which would be state funding, the other $6 million university funds. There are three key projects that we have identified for funding from this fund. The Lab Improvement Fund would invest in new facilities for the B-Lab project. The university has maintained a recognized research and extension program on honeybees since 1918. Reflecting our unique regional role in those broader ecosystems. And our lead researcher, Dr. Marla Spivak, is a MacArthur Genius Award winner, has been recognized internationally for her work on bee physiology and disease, and the outcomes of her work support critical efforts needed to ensure healthy pollinator populations, which of course is directly related then to agricultural biodiversity, and ensure safe food supply. The bee research is currently housed in two locations on the St. Paul campus. This proposed facility would replace a utilitarian cinder block structure with a building designed to support a combination of research, teaching, and demonstration activities that are at the core of the research group's work. The second improvement target is for aquatic invasive species facility. The project would result in a state-of-the-art aquatic holding facilities in what is now a former tractor garage, allowing researchers to manage exposure to light, noise, and vibration, which are critical for some of the research focused on carp. It would create modernized effluent controls and manage security of the building and associated activity more efficiently. The changes proposed to achieve these goals have been designed to accommodate a variety of invasive species research. The common thread is that all are aquatic in nature. And this is the only aquatic invasive species research that occurs in the state of Minnesota.
Vice President, we have a question. Representative Swinsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the Vice President, just kind of visiting a little bit about the EIS and, you know, kind of the bringing together of different funds from different portions of state government, looking at the DNR and particularly the Legacy Grant. You know, I know the university is doing quite a bit of research on behalf of through those funds. Just kind of, you know, we went on a tour of that facility and, you know, looking at the millions upon millions of dollars that have poured in from different portions of state government, Legacy and DNR, it just seems, you know, I think what the zebra mussel portion was essentially a home, whatever you call it. What did they call them?
Terrarium.
Yes, all right. And, you know, I just, you know, how that reflects that and, you know, I guess, how are those dollars being funded, and are they doing outside research as well through the university, not doing it all within the building itself? And yeah, just kind of wanted to visit about that a little bit. I guess, is there anyone from that portion of the bill here?
Vice President Wheelock or President Kaler, either one of you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, but thank you for the question. You're right that there is a substantial amount of funding from a variety of sources that have gone into that facility. Doing research is expensive, so we're paying the salaries of individuals doing the work. There is a lot of infrastructure in that space. It's not very handsome. I've been in that building, too. But it's effective and utilitarian, I would say, for getting that work done. We clearly do believe they could do more and do it more quickly if they had space better suited to their mission. We don't have that space in our inventory, which is why we're bringing it before you now.
Representative Friends.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, I represent an area that has been adversely affected by zebra mussels. Could you, and if you don't know the numbers now, but could you please give the committee a breakdown of how much is used for research dollars and how much is used for salaries and overhead costs?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, salaries and benefits for those individuals are an integral part of the research. You don't get the research done if you don't hire the people. But we certainly can get you the breakdown of expenditures in personnel and supplies and equipment, which would be the other major budget category. But we can get that for you, certainly.
Representative Franzen, is that? That's okay. All right. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just talk briefly about the third target within that lab improvement fund, which is our greenhouse facility replacement, which supports plant-based research and teaching. The existing building is considered obsolete due to its age, construction methods, and condition. The building houses a rare and critical plant collection used by the College of Biological Sciences for teaching and supports cultivation of thousands of specimens used to teach 16 different undergraduate classes. And then moving on to the Duluth project, the Chemical Sciences and Advanced Material Building. This is a new STEM building. The new facility will support the continued growth in the campuses Swenson College of Science and Engineering and the Departments of Chemistry and Biochemistry. The Swenson College enrollment is the largest on the Duluth campus. In the time frame from 2008 to 2012, the enrollment grew by 19%. The department enrollment grew 40% in undergraduate admissions in the same time frame. In 2012, college had to deny admission to 150 qualified applicants due to inadequate laboratory and learning spaces. So the current building was constructed in 1948. No significant renovations have occurred since that time. And the new building then will free up research labs from existing space, allowing them to be used for teaching purposes. The new building will also provide a large format classroom that's essential for science teaching on the campus. The space planned in the new building allows emerging programs in engineering design and chemicals materials testing to get established by creating dedicated space for cross-disciplinary work within the engineering discipline. The project has sparked enough interest in Northeast Minnesota industries that are willing to support a collaborative research space, a shared space, the Northeast Minnesota Advanced Materials and Mineral Research Center. So it will be approximately 50,000 square feet of predominantly research labs, instructional labs, and lecture halls. So, Mr. Chair, that is the summary of our specific projects, and I'm sure on behalf of the President and I, we are interested and able to answer questions.
Wait 1 second, please. Representative Poppy, I believe, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back a few slides, you talked about Blakely Hall and Morris, and you said that it needs to be ADA compliant, and it's not at this point. Has that previously been on the list to be funded? Or, I mean, ADA compliance is a number of years back. So I'm a bit concerned that we've not, if we have not previously heard about it.
Vice President Wheelock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy. It is, I'm uncertain about whether that has been on the list before. The Morris campus, like many other parts of our system, have a high prevalence of historic buildings, all of which have had some need. And so I will get you more specific information about that building and the accessibility on that building and whether that has been a priority in other requests. But this is very consistent with the history of requests from the Morris campus about investments in the historic structure, particularly on that mall that were part of the original residence school.
Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up, could you also get me if there are other facilities, buildings that are not ADA compliant and where they are throughout the system?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative, oftentimes it is a space within a building where we might need more handicapped accessible restrooms or switching out some of the doors to be handicapped accessible, but we'll get you a list of where we have a backlog on ADA compliance issues.
Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Three things I want to cover. The first, and I came in late, so I apologize if you covered this. I noticed in 2013 the HEPA request was 125, and this year it's 100. And so the $25 million less. I wondered if you could just let me know where that was.
Vice President Wheeler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton. Last year, in the off years, typically the HEPA is the dominant request, and that was the case last year as well when there was a hope that there would be an off-year bonding bill, and it would have been dominated then by HEPA, as it was in our request. In the main bonding bill year, there is a HEPA request along with our new changes, new buildings, and major renovations. And so to allocate resources according to the broader scope that we were considering, the HEPA was adjusted accordingly.
Okay. So you pared that down based on, thank you, Mr. Chair, based on your priorities.
Exactly.
Okay. Mr. Chair, my next question, thank you. There's just three that I had. The Tate Science and Teaching renovation, I noticed in your in some of the information here, it says that, and I recall this, I think, from our tour as well on the bonding committee, that the teaching and learning is happening throughout the campus in multiple buildings now, and that this renovation is going to help kind of realign where you're teaching. Are you able to free up space in some of those other six buildings with this renovation or not?
Mr.
Chair, Vice President Wheeler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, as is the case with many of our projects, part of the challenge we have is sequencing, that you can't go in and renovate a space until you can vacate that space to allow for the renovation. And so, again, thank you, because the investment that the university has made, along with the commitment from the University of Minnesota funds for the nanotechnology and physics space, will allow many of the physics functions in that building to move over to nanotechnology and physics. And we will still have some physics, some astronomy, and earth sciences then that will be in the renovated Tate building. But they, in some parts, they will be moving from other buildings then as well to this building. So it will be a more consolidated space and have improved space actually for classroom and for the learning that occurs in that space to consolidate some of those activities in that space.
I appreciate that. And Mr. Chair, and the last question is really more of an observation. Because I do serve on bonding, I had an opportunity to tour most of these facilities and many others throughout the summer. And I have to say, I was quite shocked at the state of the research facilities. I really appreciate these requests. I think they are overdue, and I know you have priorities, and you know, these just rise to the surface when other emergency situations sometimes are fulfilled. But I just have to say, the aquatic invasive species lab was shocking to me, and frankly, the bee research as well. These are renowned researchers. They're also programs that are recognized nationally, and they're in facilities that are, in my opinion, substandard. Mm-hmm. And the editorial comment that you won't like is that it just seems to me our sports facilities oftentimes are state-of-the-art, and we spend a lot more attention and spend more money on those than we do on programs that really are the purpose of the state and of our land-grant mission, which is academic education and research. And so I just want to say I fully support these projects, and I hope other people do as well on this committee and in the bonding committee. But it is startling to me how we've let those go in disrepair at the same time we sometimes focus our priorities on other areas. Thank you.
Neither one of you need to comment on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to, at my peril perhaps, and I'd like to make a brief comment and just remind the members of the committee, Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, and the public that our athletic investments are really donor financed. And so there is where those investments are made, it's because there's a donor that has a high level of passion for that programmatic investment. And the pace of the aging and the loss of functionality in our core academic buildings are outpacing the growth and the size of a bonding bill. And about three quarters of our major investments in capital are financed with state proceeds. And so if we can't keep up on that demand, we do tend to fall behind. And some of these requests are really fueled by the investment in programmatic spending by the state for the aquatic and invasive species research. So we're working hard to keep up with the capital aspects of matching that demand on the program side.
Representative Swizinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of looking back at page 7, the Campus Wellness Center, you spoke that the reason why we need to do that project is because the football team essentially has been taking over the campus-funded portion of that athletic facility. And I guess, you know, from a outreach, I don't represent that area. What kind of work has been done to the community to kind of raise funds, I guess, from the donors or the people that would help out in the public for that particular project?
Mm-hmm. Vice President Wheelock.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, there is actually an effort by the Chancellor to generate some interest in the donor community. I should add that there are other facilities that are shared facilities in Crookston, the ice arena in particular, for skating. The campus does not have its own facility, and it uses other community facilities. But in a small community of about 8,000, there are going to be some limited opportunities there to have a shared or collaborative approach to solving some of the facility problems. There has been an action by the students at Crookston to a couple of years ago to increase the student fee as a gesture of their support for improving these facilities. And I expect we would revisit that as well to make sure that that's at the right level but also affordable for our students. And they will continue, I'm sure, the Chancellor to meet with potential donors to see if there's an interest in improving those facilities. And that program, both for the students and the athletic program for students, is an element of kind of the quality of the student life there that is highly valued at the campus.
Representative Swizinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think the committee here would appreciate the just kind of the general tracking, just how that process goes. So thank you.
I want to return to the Heber for a second. If we stayed at the governor's number of 40 million, I'm looking at your rank order sheet, the front page is 1 to 38. If you stayed at the governor's number and we didn't improve on it, you'd only fund 1 and 2? Is that what would happen?
Mr. Chair.
Vice President Wheelock.
We actually put together that list based on a $100 million request, and I think when we know what the final number is, we're going to have to determine what we can do and what we can't do on that list, as will each campus within the system once we know what the allocation number is. But it is a challenge for us when we have a very important facility that needs a significant investment in all of its kind of integral systems, and so we'll have to evaluate that when we know what the final appropriation number is.
Well, Vice President Wheelock, if I gave you the number of 40 and that was it, then we'd have, I'll be generous, 4 through the rest of them with an array of we've got roof replacement, window replacement. It's just an incredible array of things that would not be done.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be a challenge for the University of Minnesota to think that we are appropriately making progress on the broad list of HEPA-eligible projects and to invest almost all of that in one building. And so it is a challenge, though, to think about phasing that work, because it's a little bit like a home improvement project. When you have the wall open, you want to do the electrical and the plumbing at the same time. It reduces, you know, having the cost by having multiple vendors and trades out there and staging costs and the disruption of program. But we would have to see if we can phase the mechanical engineering in such a way that we could still make some progress on improving that building without spending or investing almost 90% of the available appropriation on one project.
Vice President Wheeler, what's the totality of the backlog beyond $100 million?
Oh, Mr. Chair, we have, I don't know what the number, the total dollar value is, but we do a facility condition assessment where we have third-party vendors, architects and engineers go on-site and look at every building within basically a five-year schedule is our goal, and so we have several hundreds of millions of projects that we could do with funds that are invested. Some, of course, are more urgent than others, and that's looking at the system investment that needs to be made in a 10-year time horizon.
Vice President, I'm looking now at the university investment, where the university is putting sizable investments in an array of buildings, the Tate Science Building 28 and Microbial 15. How flexible are those numbers, assuming that you, in the governor's request, you have two gaping holes on this sheet? So is there flexibility with moving that 15 that you have where you didn't get funding for the microbial and the 12 for the chemical science? Can those be moved, or are they somehow tied to those structures and only to those structures? President Taylor.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Vice President Fitzenreiter is here, I believe.
He's right in back of you.
But I would answer with the respect that, you can amend or correct Fitz. But those two elements are tied to the source of funds to generate those one-third dollars. So the way we would budget for a building is to identify the unit that would benefit from it and look to that unit to generate philanthropy, to use cash that they may have on hand, or that we would issue university debt as long as we identified a source of repayment. So those one-third shares are really not very fungible at all.
So, President Kaler, when you say university investment, you may mean that someone is contributing or has the potential to contribute. And if the structure doesn't happen, then that potential goes away?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, yes.
And do you have, President Kaler, an idea? Is it the full amount that would be in that category, or is it a partial amount?
Mr. Chair, generally, historically, it has been a partial amount, but we are becoming increasingly aggressive in our philanthropy, and as we identify donors, we will look for increasingly larger fractions of that share to come from the private sector.
And this goes to either one of you. There's been a discussion of using cash, and in the Minsky system, there was at least one area where cash would have solved a couple of problems for us. What would be the best use of cash in your request, assuming that cash is going to be used?
Mr. Chair, I do not believe, and I look to my colleague for comment, that the nature of the money, whether it be cash or state bonding proceeds, matters very much to us.
Vice President Wheelock.
Mr. Chair, I'll just simply add on behalf of the CFO behind me that particularly where we have institutional uses that we might have a relationship with for a third with a third party, for example, for research activities, if there is any sensitivity about private use restrictions, those make for very good candidates as cash projects.
To both of you, you might want to make some decisions that would be useful in an argument for using cash in the bonding bill. If we stay at the agreement between the Senate and the House, we're at 850. The governor is at $1 billion, and there are sizable holes in your bonding request at that amount.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't move beyond the 850, it might the only capacity to do it might be the use of cash. So you might want to start considering where that would go and how it would go and the best way to use it. And you don't have a lot of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will take that under consideration.
Representative Grunhagen, you looked like you had a question and then backed off.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't want you backing off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I'm a layperson when it comes to updating facilities, but I do have a little background, having been on the school board for 16 years. But, you know, one of the things I noticed on the K-12 is no matter how much money we got in new funding, most of it gravitated into salary and benefits and additional programs, some of which were questionable, in my opinion, rather than keeping the facility up. And, of course, you have health and safety levy that you can make use of in the K-12. And then, but then, ultimately, we'd have to ask the public to kick in a referendum so we could fix the facilities up. And I'm just wondering, you know, last session we passed, if I remember right, and I'm open to correction, we passed out of committee, and I voted for it, a $100 million increase for Minsky and the University of Minnesota. Went to the House floor. I voted for it. Went to conference committee. Came back with $200 million, and, if I remember right, and I did vote against it at that point. But I'm just wondering, when we give $200 million more, if it wouldn't be prudent, and it's just something for the committee to think about, to require a certain percentage of that to be applied to updating or restoring facilities rather than just gravitating into salary and benefits and other programs. And I think what that would do is cause the universities to very carefully consider whether all the programs they're offering are really necessary, and you probably have a good vetting process on that anyway. But that's just been my experience in the K-12, and I haven't watched this long enough, but I just sense human nature has a tendency to work that way. If you'd like to respond to any of those comments. Thank you.
President Kaler.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, our relationship historically has been one where we have an operating budget, and alternatively we visit with you on bonding on every other year cycle. Certainly within our operating budget we do reserve a amount of money, it's not a huge amount of money, for repair and maintenance funds, so that is part of our ongoing activity. However, given the scope of the 29 million square feet the University of Minnesota has, we do come back every other year and ask for help for bonding. And that's a model that's been in place for as long as I know of. It certainly is something that could be revisited. But I do assure you in the operating budget there is a modest level of funding for repair and renovation.
Representative Grenier?
Okay.
In the operating budget, we also targeted the money on the House side primarily to tuition relief with selected funding for your MIN drive and then to the grant program. The vast majority of our budget went directly to students one way or another.
Mr. Chair, yes, it did. Thank you.
And you're welcome, and hopefully we can continue. I want to press Heber a little bit more. Can you explain the relationship with the remodeling of Northrop Auditorium and your first request, the mechanical engineering building? Why HEPR was used in both of, well, it was used in one for sure. There's a proposal to use it in the second. And why we're not looking at this as regular bonding instead of HEPR. Mm-hmm. Vice President Wheelock.
Mr. Chair, for Northrop, we have a building that has served an academic function on that campus for almost 100 years. And it was seriously threatened in terms of its viability, and in the early 2000s the University of Minnesota had to make a determination about what to do with Northrop and what would be the life of Northrop moving forward. There was a legislative request put in for some planning and design money for Northrop in our legislative request in 2002, which was not funded. So in 2005, the university completed a comprehensive facility condition assessment of Northrop, and that report concluded what we thought to be the case, which is that the antiquated mechanical and electrical and plumbing systems had reached the end of their useful life. The existing building systems couldn't support the existing, let alone enhanced or alternative programmatic uses. And that the building's envelope and the structural condition, while it didn't preclude renovation, it did require immediate attention to stem the deterioration and avoid potentially higher costs. So that seemed consistent with the use of HEPR. And then the institution made a determination to look at the change of the use of the building to increase its use for academic support, which it has now done, and to preserve a smaller but state-of-the-art lecture hall, performance hall in the heart of the building. That was funded where possible and appropriate with some HEPR funding. There's about, I believe, $18 million of HEPR that has been invested in Northrop, and the remainder of that was University of Minnesota issued debt. It's deemed to be an important asset for the institution. It will be an important asset for another 100 years. It's located on the historic mall, and it's a large, complex building due to the way it was structured and the inflexibility of reprogramming it for academic purposes. Mechanical engineering is similar. It's located not on the historic mall, but just adjacent to it. It's a large, well-built building that actually, if we can improve the systems in that building, will meet the functional needs for teaching and learning in that space as compared to Tate, which is really about new program as well as an investment to maintain the functionality of the space. But we are actually changing the footprint, changing the use in the building, adding classrooms, adding some new square footage. So that's why that is a new project request for Tate.
Vice President, thank you. So at $18 million for Northrop, now it's 34, almost doubling what the two buildings are. Are we going to see one in the next cycle at 68? When does it stop?
Mr. Chair, I think if we can make some progress on that facility condition assessment, I think what you have is you have, to some extent, kind of the bundling up of these projects. And again, part of the challenge is vacating the space. So we are actually moving some of the engines lab and mechanical engineering out to another building, which is a better fit for that type of use of space to meet with modern day code as well. But we have some very large buildings on campus, and so to do any one of these systems is not inexpensive. And then when you have several systems that are required in the same building, then you have the question about, is it more efficient to renovate or to replace or to phase the work or to bite the bullet, if you will, and have all of that work done in a coordinated, consistent, and timely way together.
Vice President, like, does the size of this, as far as the monetary amount, drive it to number one or the need? Be careful how you answer that.
Mr. Chair, I would say that this is a very important program for the institution. It is one where we have a national reputation, and we are recruiting quality students and recruiting and retaining key faculty in that program. And so it's really driven by the programmatic needs of that space and as well the facility condition assessment. It's a combination of the two of those.
Vice President, if the bonding bill contained a provision that said you could do whatever the number was except for number one, what would happen?
Mr. Chair, I'm really kind of looking at the president as well. I don't know the answer to that one. I think that it is a challenge. We have been kind of extending our ability to use that building, knowing that we're, you know, believing that we're on the verge of doing some renovations in that building. But if there was no financing available and no appearance that that would change in the near term, we would really have to think about whether that space was any longer usable and what we would need to do either on a lease basis or some other basis to move things around. But it is at the point where it really needs an investment in that structure.
And then can you explain the impact on tuition of the totality of your bonding request for us?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that we can give you a precise number, but there will be an impact by asking the university to share in paying for these buildings with one-third share. The university does need to look to all of the sources of revenue that it has, including tuition, to help pay for that.
President Kaler, you don't have a rough number on what that might be?
Let me consult with Vice President Fitzenreiter.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Richard Fitzenreiter, the Chief Financial Officer at the University of Minnesota. With respect to the one-third share that the university is required to pay for these projects, if the entire list of projects was approved by the legislature, the debt service impact, in my estimation, assuming 25-year bonds at about 4.5%, would be approximately $4.4 million. Now, that said, if you look past, you look in history, about a third, oddly enough, one-third of the one-third share, tends to come from philanthropy, cash, other than bonding sources. So if you adjust for that, it's about a $3 million debt service impact on the operations of the university. How that would translate into a tuition increase specifically, 1%, for example, wouldn't all necessarily happen on undergraduate tuition, but a 1% undergraduate tuition increase is about $6.5-7 million. A year.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, it was the university that began the discussion of freezing tuition at the undergraduate level, and one that the legislature and the governor took extremely seriously. We are now beginning a discussion on the viability of this debt service. It had been put in place to stop the flood of new projects. That it has not done. but it certainly has impacted, even if it's only been small in each bonding bill, the totality of it is a tuition increase and a certain commitment on the campus level, exactly where we don't want to have those resources drained. So if we continued a discussion of eliminating the debt service in this unsession year, then we might need a number, a precise one, that would be used to do that. Mr. Fitzgerald.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I was, in the interest of full disclosure, an employee of the House of Representatives on the fiscal staff back in the days in which it was the Senate's position to impose the one-third. The House did cave to that position, and that was probably around 2000. Well, it was it was probably about 1991, perhaps, 90.
Mr. Fitzner, I remember a certain Senate Majority Leader that was very fond of that.
Yes, it was a strong Senate position. And, you know, at the time it was designed to, there was a feeling that that would lower the appetite for capital project requests by higher ed because we'd have a stake in the ask. And to be honest, my observation of it since then is that really hasn't played out that way. Projects have, in fact, gotten more expensive over time. I don't sense that it limits a bigger limiting factor these days in how big anyone's capital request is or how much money they get is the fact that the state tends to cap their bonding bills at about $850 to $1 billion.
So, Mr. Fitzenreiter, I'm going to repeat the point. Since that time, we have had record cuts to higher ed, record tuition increases, and record debt. And we're trying to find as many ways as we can to begin to make higher education affordable and accessible. And I think it's time to revisit the debt service and to take, if it isn't stopping new projects, if all it's doing is increasing tuition and putting the burden on campuses, then perhaps those resources could be best used to backfill perhaps some of the projects that didn't get funded and do it in a better way. I'm trying to help you. Minsky. You're doing better at it. Minsky was a little bit more.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll let the president kick me under the table here, but I think we would fully agree with you and support those efforts.
And this goes to President Kaler. I'm not asking you to abandon your priority process. I think there's been an improvement in the capital requests of both systems since this was put into effect. And you do a good job of prioritizing. That also adds to the why have it? Why have it now when you are prioritizing and we're following it as closely as we possibly can? But President Kaler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am not going to kick Vice President Fitzenreiter. I agree completely. We would be very supportive of that realignment. We do work very hard, and we don't ask for these because we like to have new buildings. We ask for these because we need space to do the kind of research that the state wants. You visited the invasive species laboratory and the bee place. We need to do this.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, would the answer to that question change if the amount of bonding available to the university was not increased by a third to cover the university's share?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, in the short term, if the university share wasn't increased, obviously that would be a painful situation for us. But I think in the long term, it's a healthier place to be.
Thank you.
That's a good answer, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler actually toured UMD over Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. I graduated from there in 2001, and I went through Bohannon Hall and Chena, and it was like stepping back in time. So I'm glad to see that Chena is on there for some renovations. But I just want you to be very cognizant when we're talking about tuition increases to our students. And we hear from students all over, not only in Minnesota, but across the country on this rising debt. And it terrifies the students of coming out, and maybe they won't get a job in their field, and you know, then they're waitressing with their, you know, $60,000 degree or more. So just be very cognizant on that. So thank you.
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, I worry about this every single day. the most important thing we can do is make the University of Minnesota affordable and accessible for qualified students in Minnesota. I totally get it.
Any further questions of the President Kaler or Vice President Wheelock? I have two more people that wish to testify. Thank you both. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know, President Kaler, if you can answer this, but I've been a little bit obsessed with the roofs of lately, driving around. Can you tell me how much roof renovation is needed in your current proposal?
Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I cannot, but I bet Vice President Wheelock can give you a good number. If not, we'll mail it to you.
That would be great, because I've been working with a company within school districts that goes into facilities like this and can get the job done at a much greater, much less of a cost, and guarantee it for 20 years into the future. And I was wondering if you've been contacted by any such company, and if not, could you get me the right person to talk to?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, we absolutely can do that, and I would suggest that after the meeting, if you wanted to talk to Vice President Wheelock, or we can have staff be in touch with you.
There is a sheet that does list the HEPR, and there is a roof assessment. But all together would be nice. And also, I would say, how many of these roofs are flat? And I don't mean flat by 3% or 4%. It's after this winter, you should know that might as well be flat or, you know, concave. I'm a charter member of the Anti-Flat Roof Society. A pitched roof lasts 100 years. A flat roof lasts, if you're lucky, 10. And it's always $1 million to repair it starting. And then you go up from there. So pitched roofs, even though they're more expensive in the beginning, they also keep all of your equipment inside 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
They look better,
they last longer. Pitched roofs.
Mr. Chair, we will take your advocacy for pitch roofs to heart. I will just say many times we're actually replacing roofs and we have to work with the way the building was constructed to begin with, or because of the proximity of the building to a sidewalk or to another public space where you're concerned about the snow shed off of a pitched roof, there might be some other characteristics that would drive that design solution. But in this climate, we agree that a pitched roof has great value.
I'd like the same numbers that Representative Rosenthal. I'm fascinated. Boilers and, you know, flat roofs, those are two of my pet peeves. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions of these two? All right. Then next on the list is Professor Gardner.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing us.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Gary Gardner. I'm professor in the Department of Horticultural Science in the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University. And I, along with my colleague Lynn Barringer, who's a professor of nursing, who's in the House, are the faculty legislative liaisons to this body. And I'm here really to sort of introduce ourselves. Our role is not a lobbyist role. It's really to be a conduit of information between members of the legislature and members of the faculty, and ask any questions, answer any questions, or find the right person to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions, Professor Gardner? No? Thank you, but...
One comment. We are here to support the university's capital request. We think it's a very balanced request. And from our point of view, especially the projects like the HEPR project, the Laboratory Improvement Fund, and the Microbial Sciences Research Building are projects that affect a broad range of faculty in their day-to-day work. And I think that's why they're important. I just paid attention. I work in Alderman Hall on the St. Paul campus, and it would be nice to have fire alarms that actually connect to the fire department. So I think these projects really do impact on a lot of faculty work, and you saw some of them when you toured with the House Improvements Committee.
All right. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I have one more. Is there one more person on the list? Yeah, there she is. Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Stifter. I'm here at the request of the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition. I'm a junior at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and I'm studying physics, astrophysics, and math. I'm actually originally from Shoreview, Minnesota, which is about a 15-minute drive north on 35W, so not too far away. I'm here to ask for your support of the University of Minnesota's 2014 capital request. The university's request addresses areas that are in dire need of improvement: STEM education, groundbreaking research, and student well-being. These investments won't just improve our university, but they will create economic impact for us in our state for years to come. Students also enthusiastically support the user request because it will improve the student experience throughout the entire system. I'm here today specifically because I have a very unique perspective on the situation in Tate Labs. Because I am both a third-year physics student, but I'm also a physics teaching assistant. So over the past 3 years, I've had the pleasure of both teaching and learning in Tate Lab. So I know the struggle of students as they sit in crowded, drafty lecture halls, as you know, that make you sweat in the winter because they're too warm in the winter, but they're too cold in the summer. I've been forced to sit in classroom with desks barely large enough to write on, with seating arrangements that make collaboration impossible, and sight lines that prevent full understanding of the class material. I also know the struggle of educators as they attempt to inspire a love of science in their students while they have to work with outdated facilities. When I'm teaching, I do my best to help my students learn, but most of the time I end up spending a significant portion of my lab period struggling to find the single electrical outlet in our teaching lab space. Tate Lab is a historic site where many notable discoveries have taken place. It's centrally located on the University Mall, which makes it very convenient for the over 4,000 students that take classes there annually. Unfortunately, the building structure dates back to 1926, so it's no longer up to the standards of classrooms and teaching lab spaces today. The building's no longer up to code, it's falling into disrepair, and students are using their own tuition to pay for the rising heating and cooling costs of an inefficient building. Support from the state would mean that new classrooms have improved sight lines and improved seating areas, better teaching lab space with more room, updated technology, and overall a more comfortable environment to work, study, and discover in. As students learn and grow, so will the university and the whole state of Minnesota. A larger number of students with a positive science experience in their college years will mean more workers entering the STEM fields and a boost to Minnesota's economy overall. So truly, the university's request, which does include investments in STEM, teaching and research, student wellness, and much-needed repairs to a number of university buildings, not just Tate, will benefit the students, staff, the faculty, the university community, and the state of Minnesota as a whole. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Before we adjourn, members, on Wednesday we will have a bill. The unsession bill will be before this committee. I am hopeful we can re-refer that bill directly to the floor. So there will be, under the new rules, this is a vote, but it's a vote to re-refer. And that's where it would go. So just be aware that that's what will be up. We will have the three systems, while Minsky, the U, and the Office of Higher Ed. Senator Boniff and I have put extensive work, and so has staff, on this bill to make it reasonable and unsessionable, if that's a word. With that, meeting is adjourned.